So the title of my talk is Hadronic Spectral Functions in Lattice QCD at finite, at zero temperature and finite temperature. And this is the in collaboration with the several people, and we call it the MEL QCD collaboration, maximal entropy lattice QCD collaboration. With the members are Asakawa from Kyoto, and then myself, and he was a student, a graduate student, but he moved to Hitachi company, and then Kiyoshi Sasaki from Tokyo, and Shoichi Sasaki, he was in Brookhaven for 2-3 years, and then came back to Tokyo last year. And so I'm going to talk about this physics on the basis of our first paper and some recent papers, and also I'll show you some new results. So let me first start with hadronic spectral functions. What is a hadronic spectral function? And then I'll show you how to analyze the spectral function using the maximal entropy method on the lattice. And then just for the check whether this method works or not, I'll show you the example with the mock data. And then I'll go to the lattice QCD results. At zero temperature for light mesons, and also at zero temperature light baryons, the nucleon under excited state of the nucleons, and then at finite temperature for JPSI. And we got just this result a few days ago, so it's very preliminary, I mean, this last one. But nevertheless, it may be interesting for you. And then I'll summarize and then discuss something, other applications, and also the new idea to calculate the transport coefficient using this method. Okay, so what is the hadronic spectral functions? This is the imaginary time correlation function, some operator J and J dagger, and then you make an integration over the whole space. That means that you have a zero momentum projection, three momentum projection, but you still have a imaginary time there. So this you can measure on the lattice. But if you insert all the complete set in between, then you can do a spectral representation in the imaginary time formalism. And then, for example, if tau is positive, then you have this kind of spectral representation. You a kind of the Laplace transform, but at finite temperature you have some factor there, but it's tau independent. Tau only enters into this factor times the spectral function A. And the meaning of this A can be easily defined by looking at the retarded correlation function. Now this is a real-time correlation function, but again, by inserting the complete set, you have this kind of dispersion relation in the frequency space. So this operator R. Oh, this is a retarded product. So it's a commutator times the theta function. Yeah. This is the imaginary time order product. This is a retarded product. And you have the same function A. So this is a weight function in the frequency space. How this the particle state, I mean, the states of the particle coupled to this operator are distributed in the frequency space. And here, since this is a real time, and this A usually have a power behavior at high frequency, so you need to do a subtraction to make this integral finite. On the other hand, here you have a Laplace transform. Therefore, as far as tau is not equal to zero, this is a well-defined quantity, which is always convergent. Okay. Now, the explicit form of this A is just an imaginary part of this this correlation function times some factor. So at finite temperature, this is the thermal state N with the Boltzmann factor, and then you have an intermediate state times some thermal factor times the energy momentum conservation. So this A, as I said, is a quantity which have information of the state which coupled to the N and M in principle. Okay, and then just by symmetries and other things, you can prove that the spectral function for the positive frequency is for a bosonic operator J, it's minus, and fermionic operator like nucleon operator, it's plus. So you have this property. And in any case, A is positive, semi-definite for the positive frequency. And also, the PQCD tells us that if the frequency is large enough, much, much larger than 1 dB or the temperature, then you can just evaluate this behavior of the spectral function at very large omega. And it's a power-like behavior, depending on the dimension of this operator J, plus some perturbative collections. Okay, so at least at very high frequency, you know how it behaves. It's always like power times some logarithmic corrections. But at low frequency, you don't know. That's a non-perturbative region. Okay. The textbook example of the spectral function is the R ratio in the E plus E minus going into the hadrons at zero temperature. R ratio is just a virtual photon, in this case, the time-like photon decaying into the hadrons. That's nothing but the imaginary part of this cross-section is nothing but the imaginary part of this self-energy, which is this. And this is just written, because it's an imaginary part, it's written as a trace of the spectra, I mean, trace of this, I mean, it's a spectral function, times some part. And this is our ratio, so as you know that you have, at low energies, you have rho resonance, omega, phi, rho prime, and then go to some constant value. This dashed line is a calculation based on the part of the QCD, so this data should agree at least at large omega, a large root, square root of S to this dashed line. But at low frequencies, low energies, of course, this dashed line prediction breaks down, and then you have a bound state and resonance structures. Another example is the direction emission rate from the hot plasma. In this case, you have emission of the time-like photon. Time-like photon. And then, again, you can, I mean, if the system is summarized, then it's written as an imaginary part of the current-current correlation function in the thermal bath. Then again, you have a spectral function divided by something. And then I'm not going to explain this because you know very well, but this is Ceres data, which is related to in principle, to this spectral function at finite temperature. Okay, so how to calculate the spectral function in QCD, in particular in lattice QCD? This is a spectral representation in the imaginary time formalism. So this is a spectral function for positive tau, which is written. Now I'm thinking about the bosonic operator, like mesonic correlation functions. So you have some factor times spectral function, and it's, and then by using the reflection symmetry of this A, you can rewrite it in terms of as integral from zero to infinity with some integral kernel, which is completely known one, and then times unknown spectral function. So what I want to do is to calculate this one on the lattice for several different tau, and then to extract this A from the lattice data. But the obvious problem is that the lattice data, we can have only, say, 10 or maybe at most 100 data points in the tau direction. It's discrete data points. So it looks like this. As a function of tau, if you take a log of this D, then it goes to linear behavior. Because if the spectral function has a delta function peak, that gives you the exponential damping. If you take a log, then you have a linear decrease. And this slope is the mass of the particle. But at low tau, the small tau, at short distances, you have a deviation. And it in general has a power-like behavior. So it's log tau kind of thing happens. So linear and log tau kind of behavior. But the problem is that each data point has error. And also, the number of data points is order 10. Or 10, 20 or 30 or something like that. On the other hand, what we want to extract is a spectral function, a continuous function as a function of omega up to some energy. And then to reconstruct this kind of thing, probably we need order 1,000 outputs from the order 10 inputs. Because if we have a resolution of the 10 MeV, and if we want to have a 10 G, if we want to cover the 10 GeV energy region, then we need 1,000 points.
I mean, if you problem in principle, well, I mean, not all inverter problems are.
That's right. It's ill-defined. Yeah.
So in other words, even if you would have an exact curve on the other side, then you still don't have a unique solution.
That's right. Yeah. There are many, many, many infinite number of possibilities which can reproduce this data point with completely different spectral functions.
What Mannekin does as well, like, you have an infinitely good function.
No, it's not necessarily.
No.
So it's not the last. So the question that's being asked is not with data points, but suppose on the left you had a perfectly known pale blue curve.
Oh, okay.
Suppose you knew that curve, then a million data points with epsilon error bars.
Then that.
Then is it well defined?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's just the comparison of the number of data points and the number of outputs. So if the number of data points is larger than this number, then that's okay.
So it's a mathematical.
It's just,
So as an inverse problem, it's composed if you have enough data on the left.
So what I'm going to do now is to extract this ill-posed problem. I mean, ill-posed means I have a small number of data points compared to the data points which I want as an output. Of course, a chi-square fitting doesn't work because chi-square fitting, in that case, it's reversed. I mean, this data point should be larger than this one. And the Paul Ansatz people have tried. Paul Ansatz means that you have Ansatz for the spectral function and then try to fit this one by a few parameters. That's okay, but it turns out that it's very unstable. Yeah, it's.
The problem you assume the symptoms.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, sure. This integral is of course mathematically well defined, and this procedure is well defined.
In this case, you know what's happening.
Can I go to the next transparency? Because that's...
Just while we're on this question.
Yeah.
I've never seen
A
over
omega
written as an integral transform.
Has it been?
Is it ever been done? Is there a mathematical contour
inversion
of that?
You mean inversion? Mathematically, I mean it's possible, yeah. I mean, it's just
an
inverse Laplace transform, right?
It's not
Laplace
transform.
Oh, this one, aha. That I don't know.
Is there a mathematical expression for A of omega as a contour written?
But it's just this quantity. So there's no problem. Yeah. Okay. So. Okay, so the maximum entropy method, which is we found that it's rather commonly used in other areas of physics, whether it's useful or not. That's what we have first done in this paper, and then later people followed up approach, and it turned out that it works very well. So let me explain how can we apply this maximum entropy method to reconstruct this A from this D. Okay. This is just an example that the people have done in the past in image reconstruction using this method. You have a blue picture, but by using the similar kind of method, you can reconstruct. you can tell only when you compare this real girl with this photo. Otherwise, whether it works or not. But later I will show you the error, how you can And then this is Saturn image by Hubble telescope. Originally, Hubble telescope has some kind of problem, and then before fixing it, you have this kind of image for Saturn. But even if you use this one, you can reconstruct this. Okay, so there are lots of figures. The photos like this in this book, the maximum entropy method. It's written in 1997. This is a book. He's, I think, an astrophysicist or something who does this kind of thing. So if you are interested in, you can just take a look at this book. This is Springer. Okay, so what is the principle of the maximum entropy method? And it's based on the Bayes theorem, which is almost a trivial theorem. First of all, we have to agree that this from this is not unique. I mean, if the number of data points is small here and the number of data points are large here, okay, you have a lot of spectral function which can reproduce the same D within the error. So what the question which we are going to ask is, what is the most probable spectral function among the many, many different varieties? Okay, that's the question which we are going to ask. And then this can be answered by the a kind of statistical inference based on the Bayes' theorem. Bayes' theorem tells you that if you have a probability of the joint probability of the X and Y, then you can decompose into two ways. First, you have a probability of for Y, and then under Y, you have a probability of X, or the vice versa. So Bayes' theorem is this. So we just apply this theorem to the data and the spectral function. So now X is the spectral function, and then Y is data. So this is what we are interested in. What is the probability of a spectral function for given data D? If we know this one, then if we can just maximize this A to get the most probable spectral function. And if we know this one, then we can make a second derivative to estimate the reliability of the spectral function what we get. Let's see. Yeah.
There is a method which is called maximal likelihood. Is it the same method?
That I don't know. Maximal entropy method concerns about this part. Yeah.
Experimenters always use it.
The chi-square is only this part, not this part. It's taken into account. And that works only when the number of data points is very large. So we are talking about a different regime. The number of input is much smaller than the number of outputs.
Okay, so can you explain the right-hand side?
Okay. So by just using the Bayes' theorem, you can just invert A and D. So this is the probability of having the D. It's a kind of a normalization, but and we don't care about this. So this is just a constant. And then the important part is the probability of having A without any data, and the probability of having the data with given spectral function. This part we know, because once we know the exact spectral function, then the Monte Carlo data should distribute with the Gaussian distribution around the exact data which is obtained from the spectral function.
How do you get your price?
Yeah. So this is a part which is...
Why
if the number of data points is large enough, just a central limiting theorem. Yeah, I just explained it here. So PAD, this is what we are interested in, is by using the Bayes' theorem, this times this. So just let me just, since this is positive,
That's the second
term,
the PDMA joint
probability. Yeah, first one is the joint probability, and this
one. This part of the denominator, this is the second one, because you have the same expression on the previous graph, but then you have a denominator of P of D.
Yeah, but that's not important.
This is constant. This is a variational parameter A, and this is constant, so I just.
Well,
it's just a normalization constant.
It doesn't depend on A.
That's all what I need. Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
That's why you went to proportionality science.
That's right. Yes. And then I just put this one into the exponential, because what I want to do is to maximize this one. I don't care about this, the prefactor. I just care about this structure. So first of all, this part is a joint probability. Once you get A, then what is the probability of having D? This is the usual likelihood. So DA is the data, exact data, which is obtained from the known spectral function. So we are talking about a situation that the spectral function is known. Then we know the data just by doing this Laplace transform. And then the Monte Carlo data should have a distribution, Gaussian distribution, with some covariance matrix around this data, exact data, as far as the number of data, configurations are large.
Okay, the Fermi method to determine the covariance matrix?
Yeah, what we usually do is just calculate this covariance matrix using the Monte Carlo data. Okay. That's what we do.
Okay.
Okay. The other part is called the information entropy part, or the, sometimes called the Shannon-Jaynes entropy, because Shannon is the guy who introduced this information entropy, and Jaynes generalized this kind of idea to many other fields, so sometimes called the Shannon-Jaynes entropy. PA, this is the probability of having A without any data. That's a strange object. Yeah. And then I just explanation. Yeah. I just exponentiate this one. But we have some information already, because, for example, the part of the QCD predict that the spectral function is flat, or the power behavior at high omega. So we know something about this spectral
function. This is, I mean, when Rich earlier on asked, where does the extra information come from? It's all coming from this.
Yeah, it's all coming from here. So in some sense, yeah.
What before we start, what do we know about A?
Mm-hmm. It's just, asymptotically we know exactly what is known.
Well, and the problem, yeah. That's where information comes out. Yeah.
Okay, so where is the information which we add? Okay, so we just exponentiate this one and then. So, okay. So what is the explicit form this S? S has a form like A minus, I'm going to tell you about this M, but let me first just say that this is alpha, some constant times A minus M minus A log A. If you look at minus A log A, this is exactly the information entropy that Shannon derived many years ago. And then if this A is normalizable from 0 to infinity and M is normalizable from 0 to infinity, then this is just constant, and then it's nothing but Shannon's information entropy. But this form is much more general. A does not have to be normalizable. Okay, I'll explain why, how do we derive this expression later, I mean the next transparency, but let me first show you the basic idea to maximize this P. So we have alpha S minus L, which is this Q. So we maximize alpha S minus L. Okay. It's a kind of the minus free energy. L is a kind of the energy. And S is, this is the reason why S is called the entropy, but S is a kind of the entropy factor, and alpha is a kind of the temperature. If you have enough data points, then L dominates. If you don't have much data point, then S dominates. It's a kind of the balance between the entropy factor and the energy factor. Okay, so this should be maximized with respect to the spectral function. Now, what is alpha? Alpha is a kind of the fictitious temperature which controls the relative weight of this S and L. So how do you choose it? You can actually derive an expression P alpha D. So if you have a data given, then you can calculate the probability. Again, by using the Bayes' theorem, you can calculate the probability of the most probable weight, the alpha, by using the Bayes' theorem. So this already, using Bayes' theorem. Yeah, I have an explicit expression maybe in the next transparency, but alpha can be calculated once you have a data.
That's how that, what's the information that, what controls?
Maybe then I have to show you the formula.
Would it work with any alpha?
No. You have to choose right alpha, which maximizes this probability. If alpha is too large, then of course this dominates. If alpha is too small, then this dominates. And you have to have a correct balance. That balance should be determined by the data. Okay. Yeah.
If S is zero.
Yeah. The point is that you can maximize this Q, but the you have a flat space. I mean, this is a multidimensional maximization, and you have a flat surface. So any point on the surface, infinite number of points on the surface, can give you the same number for Q. So you have a region like this. Once you have alpha, you have unique maximum. And actually, I can prove that there is only one maximum if alpha is non-zero. So if there is some maximum, then it's really a maximum, and there is no other.
But alpha is some kind of constant, right?
That's right, yes.
And this constant can be calculated from perturbation theory. It is a
no.
A pi square or something like that, no?
No, no. It's from data. It's coming from data.
I don't know if that's helpful. My old fashioned way to think about this is that you make alpha extremely small, then you do ordinary chi square fitting.
Yeah.
Oh. And since you have new data and many bitcoins, you overfit the data. You find structures that aren't there. If you make alpha extremely large, then you underfit the data and just find your prior. So you should optimize, and roughly speaking, the optimum is at reasonable errors, which applies to the order of one.
That's yeah. That's old-fashioned maximum entropy. Yes.
Nowadays, there's statistical alpha around this, but it's non smallest to the same thing.
But if alpha is constant, can I calculate alpha using perturbation theory at asymptotics? Yes, I calculate.
What do you mean by perturbation theory?
Alpha depends on the
theory.
This is the physics of fitting, not the physics of PCI. If you have perfect data, then alpha is going to be zero. Right. Or if you have enough many points, even with some kind of one, you are going to
do the physics of the fluctuations of data.
Right.
Okay,
so this M is called a prior estimate. So this is where you put some information.
This you can use perturbation theory for.
And that's right, yeah. And in general, it can be any function of omega, but at least we know that at large omega, the A should behave like a constant. So we know some information of M. So what we do as a first step is to just take this M as a constant, and then change the magnitude of this constant to minimize the final error of this spectral function. That is a procedure it's a practical procedure. In general, you have to search all kinds of input information and then minimize the final result, minimize the error of the final result. As I said, that by taking the second derivative of this P, you can, maybe it's better to show you the result first then, but okay. So this P looks like this. It's fine, at the origin it's finite, and it's maximized at M, and then it goes like this. And this function, it's a simple function. Okay. Let me just say that there's no a priori parameterization of the spectral function is required. Okay.
But isn't
M a priori parameterization? M is a kind of, yes. So A doesn't.
This is a condition. You can't.
This is for A.
Yeah. Okay.
And you can, we can prove that the solution is unique. If you find the solution of this Q and the maximization, and if you find some local maximum, then it's really a global maximum. That you can prove by using this formula. And then you can find, you can estimate the statistical significance of the solution by taking the second derivative. I'm not sure I can get to the final point if I'm going to explain the details of this Shannon's chain entropy. So if you are interested in, we have a review article, and in the appendix, we have lots of discussion of this derivation. Let me just outline. There are two kinds of derivation. One is called the monkey argument, which was first done by Friedan in 72 or something. And it's simple. This is a spectral function. You just have a bean. And monkey means monkey throw a ball randomly to these boxes. Then you have a random distribution. And each bean, you have a Poisson distribution. So it's a product of the Poisson. And if you throw the ball many, many times, then by using the Starling's formula, just this one, this Poisson, product of the Poisson becomes this form. So it's very simple. It's just a random Poisson distribution at each bean. And the product of it gives you this one.
Sorry, where's the M all of a sudden showed up?
M, I just somehow rescaled, but M is related to this Poisson means lambda. And A is the actual number of balls. So M is a kind of the mean number of balls which you can get for the for each box.
Okay, so when you make assumptions about what M is, you make assumptions what the average.
That's right. Yeah. Changing M means, yeah. Changing M means changing the box of box size. If you have a large box, then the lot of number of balls can enter. But the first guess is that the M is fixed and constant, which is, I mean, at least at high frequency, it's constant. And we just take that assumption.
So the boxes are identical.
Identical, that's right. Other derivation is
a power,
but always I divide it by some omega to some power, and then I renormalize it then as a constant. Yeah. And other derivation, more not more intuitive, is the axiomatic construction. But Shannon originally take this kind of path. So you set up some kind of axioms, but none of them are, I mean, I think third one is the most essential one. If you have an independent distribution, then you can determine this distribution separately. That kind of assumption or axiom gives you essentially this one uniquely. And so this has been discussed by Shannon and James and other people. Okay. So this part, we have some, I think, nice appendix of this axiomatic construction. So you can take a look at this if you want to interest in details. Now, let me just show you, several people asked the question, what is P alpha D? P alpha D, by introducing a kind of a complete set with spectral function and then divide it to several parts. And then by doing some manipulations, you can derive that the log of P is some constant times the this parameter alpha with lambda. Lambda is obtained from the data. It's a kind of some eigenvalue of the data sets. And Q. Q is the Q which we have defined. So you have some expression for P, which you can maximize in terms of alpha.
What's Q again? Q is
alpha S minus L. Okay. That's right, yeah. So this is completely, written in terms of the alpha and the data. And here, A alpha is already maximized spectral function with given alpha.
Where did that lambda
come? Right.
That's where the information
is. Uh-huh. Lambda, lambda is coming from the, let's see, this part. And then you have some kind of matrix which can be defined from here. And then eigenvalue of this matrix is lambda.
That's not data,
that's depend on data, yeah. Yeah, this part is a little bit complicated. I don't have an intuitive explanation of this, but at least by using Bayes theorem several times, you can derive the expression.
For fixed alpha, A alpha, and
that's right. You have to determine
the maximum of the algorithm.
That's right. Yes, yes. That's right. Okay, let me show you the example. Now, this is a mock data test. Okay, so I have an input spectral function, which is this blue line. I have a nice raw resonance and then continuum, which can reproduce roughly the E plus or E minus going to the hadron spectrum. Okay, so you have raw and the continuum. Now, I just take this data and then make a Laplace transform. Then I have an exact data, continuous function of tau. And then I discretize this tau and also introduce a Gaussian error at each data point. Then I get the mock data with discretized tau. Okay, so I make a truncation and put noise, Gaussian noise. And then using this one, I try to reproduce this spectral function by using this method. Just a constant prior function. But maybe I'll show you later how you can change this prior.
Okay. It's really important that the errors on the data and the noise is Gaussian, right?
No, I don't think so. This part, when we have a lattice data, then we already knew this, what kind of statistical error for each data point.
Right, but I'm thinking about using this in, R for experiments. We can't because we have systematic errors that we don't understand.
Uh-huh.
Correct? This really assumes that the errors are Gaussian.
That's right. Yeah. So in the lattice QCD simulations, you have, again, the systematic error and the statistical error. And this concerns only about the statistical error. And you do the different lattice, I mean, the calculation in the different lattice spacing and so on. And each time you make this analysis, and then extrapolate it to the continuum limit. That gives you this systematic error. So you have to do this kind of thing again and again by changing the size and volume of the lattice. So systematic errors can be treated separately. Okay, so this one looks like this. As I said, it's linear plus logarithmic behavior as a function of tau. And then I have a data point up to 35. I mean, and then the error, Gaussian error, is already inside this small point. Now, if I take a data point from here to here, this green part, and then using this maximum entropy to reconstruct this A, then what happens is this green one. Even if you don't barely see the linear behavior, you still see already a peak, the raw peak, and then continuum. Continuum part is reproduced very well by definition, I think. Now, if you increase the number of data points from 0 to, say, 35, then you start to reproduce the spectral function very well. Even the widths is roughly reproduced. And then if you increase the data points larger, or if you make this error smaller, then you reproduce this one very well.
The only prior information that you put in is the value of the constant at the far right?
Yeah. In this figure, what I have done is just a constant. This is a prior. But I can change this prior, which is the next figure. Okay. So this is the dashed line. Dashed line is a prior. If I change the dashed line to this level, or this level, or this level, this level, the spectral function changes. But I can also put error to the final spectral function. This is the error. Error means this is the average. I mean, this band means this spectral strength taken to be the average in this region. So central average is here, and then plus one sigma, minus one sigma. This is the meaning of this error. Okay.
So that tells you. So you see a wiggle, but it tells you shouldn't trust it.
That's right. Yes. So you just minimize this final error to select the most probable M, the prior. Huh? Yeah. And of course, in general, you can have a more complicated prior, but
you might actually know the, well, I guess not in the lattice. You might actually know it from perturbation theory.
Mm-hmm. On the lattice, you can do the lattice perturbation theory. But
yeah.
That's the same thing, yeah. Okay, so now the lattice result. We have done a lot of calculations, and I'm sorry for the complicated thing, but we did a very simple thing. Lattice action, just a Plaquet action, Wilson fermion, quenched approximation. And the source and sink is just a point. So you produce QQ bar and then absorb QQ bar at some point in this temporal direction. Lattice size is typically something like this size, 20, 30, something. And I will explain the final temperature part later. But the important point is that this is just experience, but at least we have to have a number of data points in the temporal direction larger than 20 for in the case of the Dirichlet boundary condition, and more than 30 for the periodic boundary condition. So you have to have a enough large number of data points in the temporal direction, otherwise you cannot reproduce the spectral function. Okay, let me show you one example. This is spectral function in pi and rho. At zero temperature, which this is a calculation which was first done in 99 by ourselves. The lattice size is 20 cubes times 24. And here you have pi on channel, rho channel as a function of the tau over the lattice spacing. Again, you have a slope here, linear slope, roughly linear slope, and then you have a logarithmic behavior here. So usually people extract the mass of the particle by the slope here and slope here. But in the maximum entropy method, what you do is to just take a whole data. In our case, we just take data from 0 to some 12 or something, and then do this method, and then extract the pi on pole, pi plus, pi prime, and some continuum structure, rho prime, and so on. So you can fit the peak, and then extrapolate to the chiral limit and to extract the mass of the particle.
But when you draw three horizontal lines to signal an error bar, why are you drawing them in the middle of the peak as opposed to up? I mean, is that the error bar at the height of the peak? I just don't understand what you mean.
Oh, this one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
What those three lines mean.
So in this region, we just make an integral of the spectrum. And then this is the mean.
Of the area under the peak.
Yeah, and this area could be upper or lower. That's one sigma.
The length of the dash also carries some information.
Sorry, wait.
The horizontal length.
Horizontal. Oh, you can change, I mean, if you wish. I mean, if you wish, I can just make it smaller.
Indicate the width over which it was integrated.
Yeah.
Calculated, or you just draw it by
hand? Oh, I just choose it by hand to just look at whether this peak is sensible or not. Yeah.
Is the Rho prime peak sensible or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's marginal. But if you, there is later, the CP Pax collaboration in Tsukuba did a much more detailed calculation, and then it becomes sensible, and then you can make
Can you go back to the, so Rich, it's up to you to decide. You want to know if the Rho prime peak is sensible, you look at its error bars, those are one sigma error bars, and then you have to decide what you think.
Yeah, that's right.
This was optimized constant
M? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is already optimized. Okay, so CP Pax collaboration just published a paper this year. They did a very large size calculation like this, with a large number of configurations to check whether what we found is correct or not. And then this is K inverse, is the inverse of the Hopping parameter. So this is a chiral limit. This is heavy Koch limit. This is a fit of the lowest peak Rho meson, so you have you can extrapolate to the. I mean, this is actually the. I mean, that's right. Usually, I mean, you determine this lattice spacing by fitting this Rho. So this is not really agreement, but still you have this slope, and then this box with error is a fit of the height of the second peak, Rho prime. And the physical Rho prime is here, this one and this one. So it's a quenched approximation, so I mean, it doesn't have to agree, but the point is that the error is much, much smaller compared to the previous two pole fits. Previously, people have done the two exponential or three exponential to fit this data, but it's so unstable, therefore the second peak position has a very large error, but in this maximum entropy, you can use a whole range of the data. Yeah.
So the way you describe the error analysis in the plots on the right is you're estimating the error of the integral.
Yeah.
What about if I wanted to estimate the error of the omega of the peak, the location of the peak? Because that's mm-hmm. needed on the next.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Not the weight, but the location of the peak.
That's all what I can do is to just take a small beam and then place each places. You can divide this region into the small pieces and then put error in each pieces to see whether. Yeah.
That's what on the next transparency. That's what CP Pax.
No.
The CP Pax get their error bars on the next transparency.
Oh, this one is. This one is. They just. Let's see. Fit the height.
Plot of the mass of the Rho, which is the location in omega of the peak.
Mm-hmm. This is for each k, and then I think this contains only the. Oh, I don't remember exactly.
Is that just the width of the peak?
No, the width of the peak is much larger, actually. Let's see. This is for each quark mass. So this should be. I don't remember. I'm sorry. Yeah, I can check later. Okay. But yeah. This error is obvious because it's a fitting. It's coming from the fitting So how well the fitting is. Yeah. This error, solid one. Yeah, I have to check, I'm sorry, yeah. Okay, so this is the this is the thing that the one of our members of the group did for the nucleons, and the similar thing. You have a nucleon peak and also some N prime. N prime is may correspond to the Roper resonance, which is a strange resonance you cannot explain in the Koch model, if you know the Koch model. And again, the similar kind of figure. You have nucleon, and then you have so I don't also remember how they put this data error, but okay, so this kind of thing. Okay, so final temperature. What do we do at final temperature? What we do is just shrink the volume with periodic boundary condition, so 0 to 1 over T. Okay. Then at final temperature, you have a finite temperature correlation function with factor, non-kernel times the spectral function. And then if you do the simulation below TC and above TC, you may be able to see some melting of the JPSI or other hadrons. Even below TC, I mean, in the quenched approximation, string tension becomes very small as you approach to the critical temperature. So even below TC, you may be able to see the change of the JPSI. That's a hope. And in this periodic boundary condition, the data looks like this. Previously, I took a Dirichlet boundary condition, so I just cut out this part. But in the periodic boundary condition, you have this kind of data. Okay. So roughly speaking, independent data points becomes half. Even if the lattice size is 40, really in the independent data is 20. That means that you really have to have a large time slices, large number of time slices in the temporal direction. Okay. So our previous experience suggests that the more than at least 30 points, I mean the whole space, so half of this is 15, are needed in the tau direction. And 30 points in the tau direction means in the to have a real thermodynamics, you have to have more than 100 data points in the space direction. That's almost impossible in the current computers. So what we have done is to take an anisotropic lattice with 1:4 ratio. So lattice spacing in the time direction is 0.01 Fermi. Lattice direction in the space direction is 4 times this, 0.04 Fermi or so. So it's an anisotropic lattice. By doing that, you can cover the range of the temperature from below TC to 2.5 times TC with this kind of lattice. Okay. So usual lattice, the symmetric lattice, this number cannot be equal to this number at this temperature. Usually it's a zero temperature simulation. But now here, the lattice spacing is 4 times smaller in the time direction. Therefore, this corresponds to temperature 2.5 TC and so on. And the beta is 7.0, it's really a rather weak coupling, and then the lattice spacing is really small, 0.01 Fermi or so. And I just got the data a few days ago from Yuki from Japan, and then this is very preliminary, so I don't have any explanation. It's just a first result. JPSI channel below TC, tau direction is 96, and then what he has done is to just cut out, I mean, take the data points, for example, in between, and then make a maximum entropy analysis. And then you get this dashed line.
He used only the middle ones, or he threw away the middle ones?
He used the middle ones only.
Why? Why use only the middle ones?
Yeah, there is a technical point, but this N tau is 96. And then his gauge configuration is something like 100. And because of the technical details related to this covariance matrix inversion, the number of configuration is at least probably twice as large as this number of time slices. Otherwise, you cannot really make use of the whole data points. That's a little bit technical point. But so what he did is to just cut out only the, say, 32 data points. And this somehow makes sense because at high temperature, we have a lattice with 32, for example, data points only. So just compare the high temperature and the low temperature. It may make sense to take only the small part of this one instead of the whole part. But it's still a technical point. And I mean, in the future, if we have a large enough gauge configuration, then we will use whole data sets. But this is just the first result coming from only the 32 data points out of 96. Then you have a 3 GB JPSI peak, and I don't know this one, and some constant.
Yeah, only point as far as enough time, it means you lose accuracy on the
that's right.
On the tail.
The tail, high energy part. So that's why you use the information here. But on the other hand, if you take this part only, so from 4 to 19, this part, and 77 to 19, this part, then you have information of the high energy part, but you lose information of the low energy part. Therefore, the peak somehow shifts a little bit. So, yeah.
So in the blue, that seems like a reasonable place.
Yes.
What's the error? Do I, again, take that second bump seriously? What is it?
Yeah, that I don't know. It's
very preliminary.
Yeah. Psi prime is just a few hundred MeV larger than JPSI, so it's not really Psi prime, something else. But, unless I put the error bar here, I cannot say anything.
But wait,
this is a relativistic, just a simple Wilson. Yeah, and then heavy cork, JPSI mass is 3 GeV. That's why you have to have at least a beta enough large so that the JPSI cannot fall down inside this lattice. That's another reason that we put large beta.
Are you able to do zero temperature to finite temperature comparison?
Yeah, and this is finite temperature.
What was the zero temperature?
Oh, this is zero temperature. This is zero temperature.
T less than TC,
but we don't yet know what is exactly the temperature, but it's certainly less than TC by looking at the Polyakov line and behavior. Okay, now at 2 times TC, that corresponds to the lattice with this thing, and here we just take 4 to 36 data points. The reason why I took from 4 to 36 is that it's a 1 to 2, 4 times anisotropy. So unless, below 4, this lattice artifact should be large. That's why I just cut out the small tau region. Okay, so you have several structures, and then I don't have any. This is very preliminary. I just got it 2 days ago. But first of all, you don't see any pronounced peak. So JPSI, I think, melts away already at 2 times TC as expected. And some structures and with errors, I don't know, this structure may have some meaning or may not have some meaning, but roughly speaking, it's just a flat with a sharp cutoff. And that cutoff should come from twice the Chamcock mass plus plasmino mass, but plasmino mass is in this case probably small compared to the Chamcock mass. So it's roughly, it should be roughly something like twice the Chamcock mass, and it's roughly this. Okay. And then this one sometimes appear or may, even below TC, but many times this kind of peak appears above TC. And this may be related to some kind of Landau damping kind of thing in the summer bus, but this also, it's just a speculation, and we have to put, actually if we put error bars, then it's very huge error bar exists here, so. That is also, yes. That's right. In this case, omega square.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, but usually the spectral function dies away at very quickly at low frequency. So even if you divide it by omega square, for example.
No, but exactly as I said, Landau damping gives a spectral function which increases linearly with omega more.
Well. Yeah, but this is zero momentum, so it's Landau damping, its contribution is delta, almost a delta function. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Landau damping. So you have to have some kind of, this kind of thing at finite momentum. So. Oh, that is what you mean. Okay, yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that could be related to that kind of thing in the deconfined medium. But
right?
This is quenched, yeah. But still, I think there is a such kind of contribution because, this is a thermal torus, this is a tau direction. And then the usual thing is this one. But I also have a correlation like this. This with one winding number. This corresponds to the scattering of the current with the quark. So as far as you have external current, at least you can have this kind of contribution other than this one. And this corresponds to the somehow one quark coming in, and then you have current, and then other quark. That I'm not sure, but this could be an explanation.
Let me just add something very stupid. How come the C quark has such a large mass? How come you see anything at all so far below the threshold, far below what the human eye can find in a quark and anti-quark when you go up in temperature? What sense does that have? How can I describe something with the quantum numbers of the CC bar system way, way below the threshold for producing CC bar? A little bit below your standard binding, but when you just produce excitation in terms of temperature, why do you get such a huge peak?
Oh, this peak. Yeah, I don't think this peak has much sense. Yeah. Oh, this one. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It has nothing to do with the J psi bound state.
If you're very far below the threshold of forming a C and a C bar, what's wrong with saying you just can't have anything?
It's a deconfined medium. It's a deconfined plasma, yeah.
Yes, but not with the quantum numbers of C and C bar.
C and C. It's just this. Right. Yeah.
Do the light quarks?
This is
but I'm saying light.
Yeah, we have a data for the light. We have a data for light.
I need a chair.
That's right. Lower the temperature.
And then you have scattering in the system. You know that the spectral function is an odd function of omega.
Yeah, so it's just a scattering of the.
What you say, there is
a thermal
distribution of the particles
which
produce the scattering. Yeah. Only the matter. Like the loop of the CC bar, as external leg, coming with scattering on thermal particles, you make the loop. Yeah. When you cut the loop, you have a
problem. Yeah, it's the energy transfer.
Well. In the bar.
Oh, that's different. That's not the survival probability for one quark. What you speak now is about transfer coefficient. When you want to put that.
That's not doing really the same. It's the slope of the.
No, but what you show here, the spectral density is really governed by the damping rate. Well, from the point of view, it's really one part of the external light. You don't multiply the probability for having. You just look at one particle in the thermal bath, which is the same particle. So you don't care about the whole thermal distribution.
Yeah, so the energy differences matters and nothing.
Put in my hand.
Right, yeah, that's right. So only the energy transfer matters, and I mean, yeah.
Can we back up? One second, I just want to understand the data. Go back up one.
Oh, okay.
Is there, it looks in this one here like there is actually a slight damage.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this one?
No, keep going down here.
Oh. Yeah, that's why I said that if the data points, I mean, the data are not good, sometimes we have this kind of spike at the origin. So we have to think more about this. And yeah, that's why maybe some are scattering, but maybe just the badness of the data or something. So yeah, it should be.
We should wait.
Yeah, you should wait, maybe.
It looks like the Hickory maybe is always going to be the most uncertain.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you
see this
being
able for any other calculation, or is it just
C1? No, any other light mesons, rho, pi, that appears. Yeah. And if the I have a figure, but if the data is not so good, then even at zero temperature, that kind of peak appears. So that's why, I have to think. We have a data for the rho meson at finer temperature, but not analyzed yet. Yeah.
You can't show it though.
No, not yet. Analyzed completely. I mean, all we have done is only the JPSI so far. So, yeah.
So the rho meson at finite temperature is coming?
Yeah, I think so. And the other scalar and the pseudo scalar, everything is coming because the data is already there. So.
Quenched?
Quenched. That's why I first analyze the data of the JPSI because maybe JPSI is more sensible to analyze first in the quenched approximation. Now, so what we have done is this: using the maximum entropy method, we have done the analysis with mock data and the lattice data. And the advantage of the maximum entropy method is, of course, the ground state it's okay in both pore fit and maximum entropy, but the excited state, this is unstable. It's reasonable, and the Q-Cuba continuum and so on. You can even reproduce this Q-Cuba continuum, although you have an input, this function m, but you can change m to see how what is the correct Q-Cuba continuum as a result of the calculation. And finite temperature, the method doesn't change at all. Only changes the data. So that's straightforward in principle. And of course, you have to have a lot of data points. So you really have to do the anisotropic lattice simulation. Otherwise, you cannot get anything. Now, future or the current topics, zero temperature, this is a very good suitable method to analyze the nucleon resonances or glue balls, heavy systems, because heavy systems, the spectra, I mean, this data points are concentrated only in the low tau region, so you can. And the hadronic mixing, full QCD simulation, if you can do that, then you can study the decay processes. And this is a completely different subject, but if you can calculate the moment up to, say, 15th order or something on the lattice, then again, this is a kind of the integral transform, so you can apply this to the.
Is there any, I mean, other than the need for a bigger computer, is there any obstacle to doing all this with full QCD?
No, I don't think so. So only the computer power.
It's just computer power.
Yeah. So just wait 5 years.
So then you really could have a. But you also, in order to see the rotating edge of pi, you need a quark mass, which is light enough.
That's right, yeah.
That the row, that
yeah.
Two pi on your lighter than the
yeah.
row.
Yeah.
So you'll need unquenched and fairly, relatively light quark masses.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be hard.
Yeah, that's right. But even in the quenched level, we can, try to extract the integral here. That has a physical meaning. That's a rho decay constant. And then that agrees with the experimental number. So that kind of thing you can do, even in the quenched level.
But quenched is okay for low heat plus and minus, right? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's what I mean. Rho decay constant into the dictates the pi decay and also E plus E minus decay. Universality. By using universality, yes. Okay. And finite temperature, this is ongoing. And then maybe near TC, you may have some collective soft modes and so on. You can study in principle in the future. And then transport coefficient and some other applications.
How do you know the difference between parallel
separation? Is it a general question or what?
in your lattice,
yeah.
How do you know what's going on?
The Q-bar-Q condensate we can calculate, but in this quenched approximation, the critical temperature is 250 MeV or so. It's high above the realistic temperature. So it's just a qualitative study. I mean, yeah, qualitative.
Something like this, A and rho max
become the same. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. That's a nice, yeah, that's right, yes. So A1 can study, and we have already done A1 simulation too at zero temperature. So
you don't have to worry about defining mass. Just look at this, if you can really get spectral function.
Yeah.
You look at those spectral functions.
Yeah, should become degenerate. That's right, yes. Between rho and A1, or pi and sigma, those kinds of things.
Also, they should be confined, right? Those things.
Yeah, that's right.
Should be restored.
Yeah, yeah. In the quenched level, I mean, chiral restoration is driven by the deconfinement. So.
How do you assure that both are here at the same time? You can't say there is chiral synergy restoration because the mass has become the same. But you see at the same time that deconfinement is simultaneously or simultaneously.
Yeah. Okay, and then transport coefficient. Maybe just one transparency. Transport coefficient, we have done anything about that, but just last week I think there may be a way, and I had ideas, so maybe you can give me some input. Usually the transport coefficient on the lattice, I mean, again by using the maximum entropy, this is the energy momentum tensor correlation function, which again can have this spectral structure. And transport coefficient shear viscosity or something is proportional to the derivative of the spectral function at the origin. So if you have a spectral function like this, then you need to extract the slope at the origin. That's hard. And I think
okay. Yeah, this is the point of Arts' talk here.
Arts'
talk was to justify the word hard.
Uh-huh. Well, I think this is no way. I mean, there's no way to extract this spectral function at the origin using this method. But by doing a little twist, you can do this kind of spectral representation by making a partial integration. You can easily prove that the tau times beta, beta is 1 over t, minus tau times gt, can be constant plus different kernel and the different spectrum. Of course, k tilde and rho tilde are related to this k and rho, but you can rewrite it in this form. And this is tau independent. Therefore, if you can measure this one, then multiply this one, and then if you can extract the constant part, then that's a viscosity. And the problem here is that you have another spectral function, which is not positive definite. But there is a way to treat this kind of non-positive definite spectral function. The idea is very simple. Just write it as a difference between the positive definite two spectral functions. And then do the same thing, the maximum entropy. So I hope that this method will work in the future. And this is not that so difficult. I mean, the same lattice simulation, and then just try to extract a constant part. OK, so this is an idea which I got recently. Entropy for the positive negative distribution is just, I mean, this is an explicit form of k tilde and rho tilde. Actually, rho tilde is nothing but the derivative of this whole thing. Therefore, it's really a difference between the positive one, two positive distribution. So rho tilde can be written in u minus v, and each one a positive definite. And then just to define the entropy as the sum of each two, and then maximize this one with L. Okay, so that's the method which I think can
essentially transform the calculation of viscosity via the sum rule, where we use the derivative of the energy everywhere.
Yeah, that's right, yes. People thought that the maximum entropy method works only when this rho is positive semi-definite, but it's not true. You can formulate even when this one is negative. So So this may be a way to avoid this kind of problem. Okay, so that's it.
I'm always amazed on how this procedure produces peaks from a function D of tau, which looks perfectly smooth. And my question is, can you show me the difference of the function D of t corresponding to a spectral function with a peak and one that just smoothly rises like omega?
Yeah. Smoothly like omega square.
What would correspond to your constant n?
Well, that I'm not sure I have. What I have is only, actually. I mean, you can play a game, a lot of game using mock data. And for example, here is this axis is a, I'm sorry for this one. This axis is the number of data points which you take. This is a error bar. So you have large error bar for each data point, small error bar for each data point. Now, the input spectral function is the delta function peak times some bump. As far as n is large and the error is small, you can reproduce the peak and then the broad bump. Is that satisfied?
That's not my question. What if I see g of tau from the lattice data and I look at it, what tells me whether I have a peak in there or not a peak? Is there a peak or it has melted away? Can I see that right away before I go through all this machinery or
Yeah, but this is a Dirichlet boundary condition. So in the periodic boundary condition, all what you have is always this kind of structure. So this part changes as a function of temperature.
But how do you know when I'm looking at it whether it's still a peak or whether it's just something?
Yeah, that it's very hard to tell from this structure. Yeah, but
he's asking about the peak at mass equal to zero.
No. So
let's ask the second half of this question. Suppose you had a spectral function with no peaks, just flat everywhere.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What would D look like?
At finite temperature.
No, zero temperature.
Oh, zero temperature. Oh, it's just a power. So it's yeah.
So the point is
log tau. Okay, log tau.
If the thing flattens out, then you get a peak.
Right, yeah, this and this. Yeah.
Okay. And what was that?
I have two questions. One is, if all of this stuff you did with the prior effort was a constant.
That's right, yes.
Do I gain anything, or? So the can of worms if I start playing with that. And I put whole Lorentzian priors as well, some of Lorentzian.
Yeah, we have not tried, but what we have tried is just we start from constant m and calculate the spectral function. Then you have some kind of structure. And then use just this one as an input.
Yeah,
and then, rotate
it.
Does it
reduce the error?
No, it reduces the error at first few steps, and then it stays constant. So, yeah. I mean, it's converges to some point.
So I can reduce
it. Yeah. A little bit, yes.
My second question is on, maybe it's premature, but in this last method that you were describing for viscosity, do you have any quantitative, semi-quantitative estimate? What kind of data, how accurate would one need to extract
No, that depends on this positive-negative distribution of maximum entropy. So I have no idea. Yeah. Nobody have tried yet.
I think
because he believed in this positive definite spectral representation, right? So I think that is hopeless. I think.
It's very useful to have some kind of error bars. I mean, what kind of
That so is agreeing with Peart that it's hopeless the standard way.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's
so it's
trying to avoid this critique.
Yeah. But we can test it using mock data without doing any data simulation. Right. So that can be done.
Just heuristically, that part is going to be the most sensitive to all your assumptions.
Right. Yeah.
So it's the hardest thing to extract.
Yeah. I think
Sanyang is that. If I add two linear functions, I still get linear functions.
Mm-hmm.
How can I get?
You mean these two peaks?
Yeah,
you have two exponential. I mean, slope is different.
Well,
you cannot tell by your eyes. No, no.
I can see by eyes.
And actually, this is really.
So NMO has more entropy.
Right.
NMO has maximum entropy.
And actually, this is not linear. This is not actually linear. It's bending very slowly. That gives you this width. Okay, this one. So in the realistic full QCD simulation, you have to have a bending of this linear slope. That gives you a real width. So it cannot be linear in the real world, and it has a smooth change, which you cannot tell by your eye. Maybe I don't can.
Where are they? I see one slope there.
Well.
By the way, what is this little thing at the end here?
This is the boundary effect, and this is the Dirichlet boundary condition. So
we're not supposed to look at that.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why I just cut out this part. Yeah.
I guess, in spirit, the question people are asking are, given what you've learned from this sophisticated method, can you now look at those curves on the left without doing that, can you develop intuition, which you could then teach us,
mm-hmm.
such that you could look at the data on the left,
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, there's going to be one bump roughly here, one bump roughly there. Just has all this trained your intuition to just look at these curves and tell them, get the right answer? You still need the fancy method?
There is a kind of a simple way to do the similar thing developed by Peter Lupage recently. It's the same with the maximum entropy method, but it's a reduced version of the maximum entropy method. So what they did is to just introduce the parameters, maybe six parameters, to parameterize the spectral function. And by using maximum entropy method, you can do a much better thing than the simple two-pole fit and so on. So maximum entropy is.
Just answer your question. Just imagine the photo of the girl at the beginning.
Yeah.
What kind of intuition you could have to say if she's pretty or not before making the photograph clear enough? You can't.
Well.
Nobody would ever ask that of an experimentalist. Can you look at an event display and measure V2?
But it is a fair question in the following sense. With experimental, even though I know to get honest error bars, you have to do the honest analysis. But with V2, I understand what it means, right? I mean, V2 of 0.17, V2 of 1/6 means you have twice as many particles going this way as you have going that way. So that's a simple picture of what it means. And what we're asking for is not, you can't get error bars without doing the work, but whether you can actually, by looking at the data, get a sense.
Is there something more subtle going on along the lines of what you were saying? You see on a semi-log plot, you see a straight line, which means an exponential fall off, and everybody has always been told that when you're doing Euclidean functions, the exponential fall off, you get
above
the mass off.
Right.
Boom. End of story. So are you saying more than that?
Is he saying more?
Yeah.
Yes.
He is saying more than that because he's getting a second bump. Much better.
No, no.
And he's getting width, he's getting second bumps.
Second bump is on the
error bar is much larger than the second.
Okay. Oh, but in the CPPAX, you have a very small CPPAX collaboration. They have done a very massive calculation, and the second peak is really a sharp one. So,
by the way, the real thing which we're all waiting to see is what happens to the Rho meson. Unfortunately, what we're all waiting for is unquenched
lattice.
This
is quenched.
Just for Fred, yes.
Well, where did the information come from for this picture of the world?
I don't exactly know how they did it. So but it's almost the method is the same. And
I actually know the answer for the Hubble, so it's probably the same for the girl. With the Hubble, the extra information is knowing what kind of noise it was. With the Hubble, the point is, they knew a lot about, even before they fixed the telescope, they knew what the problem was.
Yeah, and what my voice spread was wrong period.
Right, right. But that, and that introduces basically a point spread function at every point. It basically it blurs. Mm-hmm. They knew, you know, you look at a point source, a star, mm-hmm. and you see how it blurs. Mm-hmm. And so basically every point on this has been blurred in a known way. Mm-hmm. And it's knowing that information that allows you with the maximum method to reconstruct this.
Why do you want to use maximum?
Yeah, well, it's
not know what the problem is with the curvature right.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I don't know if you need maximum. I don't need maximum.
The effect is the same problem. It's a hard to inverse function. It's simply to take a short picture, blur it.
Right.
Yeah. It's a completely deterministic and invertible conversion
right.
Yeah.
It's much harder to run it the opposite.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the same sort of
yeah. Thing. I think they just took a constant image.
I actually remember going to talks about this at the time, how this was done, and it is this experience.
But now we're trying to do it with 10 pixels.
Right. Are there other questions? I forgot to put my hands up. Okay. That's thankful, sir.
Okay. Thank you.